When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 63. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading down to Middlezoy in Somerset to talk to conservationist, wildlife photographer, naturalist and writer Simon Phelps. Simon, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you for inviting me on the podcast. It's good to be on it.
That's okay. I should tell you when I wrote your introduction out there before, and I practiced reading it out because I have a habit of stumbling over my words. And I actually kept saying, it took me ages to get it naturalist. I kept saying naturist. So
I do like the word because it describes somebody that is interested in all species groups, which I am. So I'm not just a bird watcher or a butterfly person. I like everything. So I think it can confuse people in that way.
Yeah, okay. And you live in a beautiful part of the world. Have you been out and about in the countryside today enjoying the weather?
Yeah, I went for a walk this afternoon because there's a last winter I found a brown hair streak egg, quite a few in the hedges near where I live, which is a species of butterfly. Okay. And I wanted to find the caterpillar, and I found it about 11 days ago, which I was really pleased at because I hadn't seen the caterpillar before. So I'm going back regularly to check and see how it grows and changes. Wow. So I wanted to go for a walk anyway, but on the walk I go and pop past and try and find the caterpillar again. I did manage to find it, I walked out around the footpaths to kind of go along some of the levels. There was quite a lot of wildlife about because it was quite hot. So dragonflies and damselflies and beetles and things. And because I do wildlife photography, I can spend hours just in a tiny little bit.
I'm sure. Just tell us a bit about that area where you live, because it's quite a unique place, isn't it, really, the Somerset levels?
Yeah, so I haven't actually been living here that long. I've only been living in Somerset for about 3 years, mm-hmm. 3.5 years, which I moved down here for the job that I'm now doing. Mm-hmm. But previous to that, I moved here because my girlfriend's from Somerset and I've been visiting her for about 4 years. Okay. So I know it a little bit. We're sort of on the edge of some of the levels, or they call them moors as well down here, mm-hmm. although they're not sort of upland moorland areas. But it's grazing with sort of ditches full of water along the edges and willows, mm-hmm. Then other sort of rough grass and things and scrub. I feel quite lucky to live in this village because the countryside around it doesn't feel that intensively mm-hmm. farmed. It feels sort of like there's quite a lot of rough patches, and it's got some nice species and nice wetland species as well because of that.
Yeah.
And not far away, there's an RSPB reserve, which has got a lot of nice birds on. And then further up into the levels, there's the kind of trio of nature reserves that are the key places where most people go, where they've got a lot of the rare wildlife there, which is really, really nice.
Absolutely. Okay. And anyway, they said it could never happen, didn't they? A farmer and a conservationist engaging in what I hope will be a polite conversation. And
it's interesting that, because I think when you spend time on social media, which I know both of us seem to do quite a lot, mm-hmm. You can be led to believe that there is a big divide between farmers and conservationists, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's as big as lots of articles or discussions on social media would make out.
Yeah.
Big, probably at a local level. So in my job and other people's jobs in conservation, the divide isn't that big. And I think there is a lot of good work going on around the country.
Yeah.
But you sort of, the social media debates often, you doesn't show up in those.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, that's mentioning social media debates, and that's how we first came across each other, because I posted a picture of me hedge cutting with a lovely rainbow in the background, and you popped up and told me about that my hedges were in shocking condition and hurt my feelings a bit.
I'm sorry about that. I said sorry to you, I think directly and indirectly via that article. Although that article had been mostly written before I spoke to you. It's an important point you make, because I think I'm someone that does try quite hard to be balanced in both my articles and what I write on Twitter, but social media is very easy. It can lull you towards writing things that are a bit more sort of polarizing. And I'm never afraid to apologize and say that I was wrong if I was wrong. So, but some people are, but.
I very quickly sort of realized that, because you know, we got chatting back and forth a bit, and that's why I thought it'd be good for us to have a talk on the podcast and see if we can find out a bit more about what each other are doing. So I'm very very glad that you came on. So
as I said to you, this is the first podcast I've been on, so I'm happy to have been invited on. Experience.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're not from Somerset originally. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Peterborough, so in the which is in the east, and not far from the East Anglian Fens. So in a sense, quite a similar landscape. Although over there, if it's not fenland, it's mostly agriculture, arable farming. Whereas over on the West Country now where I am, it's livestock. And so I did spend quite a lot of time in the wetland reserves that are just outside Peterborough, because the Great Fen Project, as it's called now, has been for about 10 years or so. Two of the best fenland reserves there are not far from Peterborough, so I spent quite a lot of time there.
Okay. So growing up, were you always interested in the natural world and the outdoors?
Well, it's interesting because I was a part of, until very recently, a national network of young conservationists called A Focus on Nature. And there's that sort of starts at early teens and goes up to age 30.
Mm-hmm.
Made a lot of new friends through that. But a lot of the people within that network who are younger than me, they seemed to be much further ahead than I was. So when I was at school and things, I liked wildlife, but I didn't actually learn what anything was.
Mm-hmm.
I just liked being outdoors. I liked looking at insects and things, but I never learned to identify them all. But some of the young people that I know now are incredible sort of naturalists.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents sort of loved being outdoors and loved walking. So we would go on walking holidays around the UK, different places like Lake District and Peak District and things.
Yeah.
And so I always loved being outdoors, but I was never as into identifying and learning about natural history and things as I am now. I think that came when I was at university.
Okay.
Later on.
Okay. So what did you study at university?
I did a BSc in geography because that was my favourite subject at school. And then I specialised in ecology modules because that was where I was introduced to it.
Yeah.
And then I did a 1-year master's in applied ecology and conservation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And where did you take that? What role did you move into after that?
Yeah. So as with many people that try and get jobs in conservation, it often takes quite a long time and it's extremely competitive. So I spent about 9 months to a year doing just temp jobs with an agency and offices and things whilst I was applying for conservation jobs, and I was applying for them anywhere. I didn't mind where I moved to in the country. to work in conservation. And my first job wasn't really a proper job, as you'd call it. It was a volunteer placement with the Cambridgeshire Wildlife Trust.
Okay.
I was able to do that because I could live at home with my parents. So they paid for your travel and some training, but you didn't get paid anything.
Okay.
So I did that full time for 9 months, and that was with their reserves team. So trained to be a reserves warden, basically. So you did your chainsaw and brush cutter certificates and learned about habitat management on all of their nature reserves in Cambridgeshire.
Okay. So you gained quite a lot of practical experience then.
Yeah, it was really good. And I really like that work. I still do. And I do still do some of that as part of my job now.
Yeah. Okay. So where did you go on through? Where did you get your first permanent role?
Yeah, so I completed that placement. It took about 9 months, and then I managed to get a short-term paid contract with the Lowarth Estate on the Dorset coast at Lowarth Cove. So they don't do it every year. I think it's sort of once every 2 years. They hire a survey team, and they try and target graduates because they partially run it almost as a training scheme. And it's just for the summer months to survey the wildlife on their reserve. So they've been doing a huge amount of ecological monitoring of butterflies, plants, dragonflies, birds across their land.
That's a really interesting stretch of coast as well, isn't there? There's all the fossils there, isn't there?
Yeah.
On the beach.
Yeah, I think part of it's World Heritage Site or something like that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And it's a place where lots and lots of people kind of go on holiday, and I felt very lucky to be working there and staying there. And I learned so much about species ID there. Sort of learned a lot of plants, got better at butterflies and moths and birds as well. It was really good. And then managed to get a job for a 1 year contract with the Warwickshire Wildlife Trust on a youth project that they'd got funding for in Birmingham, well, North Solihull, sort of on the edge of Birmingham. So I moved there and did that job, which that was quite a learning curve because I had done a little bit of public engagement and youth work, but not very much. So I had to learn quite quickly, and that was all in urban sort of parks, so the council's parks. They got some nice ones in North Solihull, even though it's quite sort of an economically deprived area. They've got some nice woodlands and lakes, and that was sort of aimed at getting young people. I worked mostly with secondary school children sort of to learn about wildlife and the outdoors. But that project finished after a year, and then I managed to stay with them for about another 2 years doing different community engagement projects, sort of one in Coventry, and then I did another one back in North Solihull again.
Yeah, it must have been a pretty rewarding role, though. I bet you would have got a lot out of that.
Yeah, definitely, and especially the last one that I did, which was funded by the council's public health department. And it was the first sort of funding they'd given as a council to looking at the way in which you could use kind of the outdoors to improve people's physical and mental health. So I worked with people from mental health services or with drug and alcohol addictions and long-term unemployed to sort of, we'd start doing things like community gardening, or we did some woodland management work. So I'd have things going every week, and then we'd try and do regular monitoring of their physical mental health. And it was just the group of volunteers that I managed to build up. I sort of became friends with them. It was really, really nice. They were such nice people, and they obviously had lots of different problems in their own lives, but it was really, really good, and I was quite sad when I left there to move down to Somerset.
There does seem to be, I've got four young children in primary school, and they do a forest school every week. They spend one afternoon a week in doing outdoor learning, the kind of thing you've been talking about. You know, I know that a lot of other schools do too. There does seem to be far more emphasis on that kind of thing now than there ever has been before. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I've come across more and more schools now doing forest schools and training teachers in it, and I know more conservation charities as well are doing more education work, and particularly the health element as well. That started to get a lot more prominent. So we obviously started our health project a few years ago where I worked before, and there were a few other wildlife trusts around the country that were doing health projects, but there's more now, and there's been more sort of media coverage and some studies done, I think, as well.
Where did you move from there? Is that where you went to Somerset next, I presume?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, yes. So now that was for a job with Butterfly Conservation where I work now. And that initially it was for to do a funding bid for them, so to product development for a lottery bid. So I did that, and that was focused on the project that I now work on, which covers Exmoor, Dartmoor and Bodmin Moor. And I am the conservation officer. So I work with landowners, farmers, focusing on rare butterflies that are on those three moorland areas. And it's a 3-year project. So it's the longest contract I've ever had in my career, which is quite nice to have a bit of leeway.
A bit of security, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been delivering that project for about a year and a half now, with my colleague who's the community engagement officer. So she does work with volunteers and school groups and other things, and then I cover the working with landowners and looking at the habitat management and things like that.
Okay. And do you generally get a good response from the farmers and landowners? Are they generally keen to work with you?
Yeah, I think the vast majority are. We were lucky on Dartmoor and Exmoor in that I inherited my line manager's work, and she'd been working with the landowners on those two moors for about 5-6 years. So they already know a lot about what we do, and they get it and support it. Whereas Bodmin Moor was a new landscape where we as the charity hadn't worked before, although the Cornwall branch of volunteers had worked with some landowners on Bodmin Moor before. So we had some people who already knew about it, and some of the new people I've been speaking to are all open to it. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because as you probably picked up on me just describing my career path so far, I'm quite new to working with farmers. It's only been on this project, which I've been doing for a year and a half. So I'm still learning quite a lot, which I enjoy. But I don't know if it helps that I'm new, because it means I approach it with completely open mind. Yeah. So I go and meet farmers, I'm actually wanting to find out what they do and learn from them about their farm, and then I can tell them about the butterfly and we can have a chat about it, and it normally goes really well. It is interesting as well because it varies, so there's different landowners on these moors. So some of them might be quite wealthy people who aren't, you know, they're not proper farmers, they've come from London or somewhere, bought the house, which then comes with quite a bit of land that they don't know what to do with it, and that's quite good thing, because I can go in and go, oh, you can do all this nice place work if you want. And then you'll have others who are quite small scale farmers on some of these moorland areas who do still almost farm in a bit more of an old fashioned way. And they kind of, that's good. And then you have some who a bit more commercial and have bigger farms, so they've got more animals. And it's not that the commercial farmers aren't interested. It's more that they're often happy to do what you want, but they're not as interested in it. Yeah. They kind of like just let you get on with it.
And yeah. When you say butterflies, I mean, what kind of different species of butterflies are you seeing? Are you seeing lots of different kinds? Is it a couple of particular ones? Or
yeah, this project focuses on a suite of fritillary species that are nationally really rare. So the fritillary group of butterflies have, most of them have suffered some of the largest declines mm-hmm. of all our butterfly species, because they're quite fussy and yeah. sensitive to the habitat that they want. But the moorland areas south of the southwest do retain quite good populations, and they're nationally quite important butterfly areas because they've retained quite a lot of these fritillaries, whereas a lot of counties have lost them now, they've gone extinct. So you've got things like marsh fritillary or high brown fritillary, and they cover two different habitat types. So we've got ones that are on south facing bracken slopes, and the others are in wet grassland, sort of in the valley bottoms. Mm-hmm. So roche pasture, so millennia and rush, wet grasslands.
You said that you hadn't encountered before this role, you hadn't met many farmers. Did you have any preconceived ideas of farmers and the environment that have been changed since you started working with them?
Yes, which for me, I've been really happy that I'm obviously still got a long way to go through my journey through learning about all these things, but mm-hmm. I'm pleased that I've become more self-aware and as I mentioned earlier, balanced is yeah. I think balance is the key to everything, and we all need to learn more and be more balanced. But yeah, to return to your question, I think most people who start to get into conservation or whatever age, you learn about, you do see the main factor that is given for majority of species declining is, you know, agricultural intensification uh-huh. or habitat loss due to agriculture, or however it's phrased. And that obviously does give you an image of farming
yeah.
destroying wildlife areas, which will have and does obviously happen,
yeah,
and will have happened in the past. But I think it might give you the impression and that farmers don't care about wildlife, which is obviously not true. But I think what I've learned most, one of the things I've learned most through this project and actually meeting farmers is just how, I struggle to think of the right word for this, but how intelligent they are. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, in that I didn't think they're intelligent, but actually that I'm just amazed at the level of knowledge that they have to hold in their head at any one time.
Yeah.
I feel like if you called farming a job, like any job, it's got to be one of the jobs that I feel like requires the most kind of initiative and flexibility and knowledge, because I've just been amazed at some of the conversations that I've had with farmers through my job, who they just seem to, it's hard to explain, but they almost have to sort of have lots of plates spinning.
Tell me about it.
And I find that really impressive, because I think there's not, you know, you'd have to be quite a unique person to be able to do a job like that that does require that much, you know, planning and coordination and also it's similar to my job, in that jobs that are based outdoors, you've got to be quite flexible, because the weather and other yeah. things can change, so you can only plan so much, and then your plans might have to change, and you might have to completely change what you're going to do that week or that mm-hmm. day, and that's the same for me, but it's also obviously the same for the farmers, which then adds another level of complexity to yeah. everything. And I think I hadn't appreciated that before, because I didn't really know that much about the complexity of managing a farm before.
Why do you think Are we not very, if we do care about the environment as farmers, and we want to improve habitat on our farms, why are we just not very good at putting that across to people? Are we not very good at communicating that, do you think? Is that partly our fault? Or is it, or are we just a bit of an easy target? Or a bit of both?
I think, yeah, it might be a bit of both. I mean, I think sometimes the media might not help because it does like to portray things sort of a binary way. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the hardest things is that, and it's really difficult for conservationists like myself, in that we can't lie to people and deny the fact that the reason wildlife's declined from when data sets began, mm-hmm. say in the 70s, but it would have obviously happened way, way before that, is due to farming changing. And that's not, and I say farming because there's a difference, I think, between farming and farmers. So it's not trying to, I think a lot of the time conservationists aren't trying to sort of personally attack or blame individual farmers and say that they did it deliberately. It's just saying it almost in a statement of sort of fact, objective way, that farming's changed and this means these species have changed. And obviously that in itself, communicating that, will create this idea that it's all because of farming. Yeah. Will think, oh, it's all because of farmers, and then it leads to that view.
I mean, as farmers, it can feel as if almost every day there's someone new attacking us for being a farmer. And the problem is, then it makes us, or I think it does, makes us overly defensive. And then when there might be someone who might be making a very sensible point. A bit like you were about my hedges, but my first instinct is to be all defensive and when and your friend Mr. Monbiot and people like that are very sensationalist in their approach, and it just doesn't help. An ultimate loser is nature, isn't it? Because
I completely agree, and I've had other farmers say that to me in my job as well, and completely right to feel like that and get defensive. And someone said to me, a farmer on Bodmin Moor, she said to me that, and I think this is quite interesting, she goes, farmers are only ever valued when there's a war on.
Well,
because then they can provide the food. Mm. And she says, other than that, they're never treated very well. Mm. This is partly why I guess I came on the podcast, but also in the hedgerow article that I wrote, and some of the things I'm now communicating more about on Twitter and following more farmers, I want to, if I can help, or the way I can communicate, I want to try and make that better.
Yeah.
And I think that we should challenge people more when they say sensationalist things like about farming, because it's not right. That's sort of one of the issues I've taken up with people. About, for example, they'll brand the whole of the uplands as having no wildlife, which is obviously stupid.
Yeah.
It's just saying things like that, as you've just pointed out, will make, I don't know, any farmer in the uplands just get angry and not want to engage, and then it knocks on and makes people at my job, my professional world, harder. There's people like me who just want to have a chat with farmers. I'm not going in with an agenda necessarily. Then they'll have a view of conservationists. It's difficult.
And I suppose organizations like the new Nature Friendly Farmers Network, things like that must be helping to bridge the gap a bit.
Yeah, I hope it does. They got in touch with me as well after the Hedgerow article, which was really good. Mm-hmm. Martin Lines, who runs it, and he wants to do something on hedgerows with me, which is really, really nice. So hopefully that can help. And I think that network's good. I think, I don't know a huge amount about it, but I know it's run by farmers, but it's sort of backed and then supported by all the conservation charities, or lots of them anyway. They kind of support it and want to try and maybe find other people who can be a part of it. So yeah, I think hopefully that will get more publicity and more reach.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we've mentioned the hedges. Why don't you sum up that piece you wrote? It's called "Flail to Death," which is, by the way, is an excellent title. I love that. It was a brilliant, very yeah. It worked really well. But what
I wasn't sure if you would have thought it might be too emotive.
No. I thought
that was something I did address in the
post. No. It was very, very good. Why don't you sum that piece up a bit and tell the listeners a bit what it was about?
Yeah. So for years, really, a lot of my articles that I write, I end up thinking about them for years, and that's not an exaggeration though. I see the hedgerows cut every year, and it genuinely does upset me. Not that I didn't understand why they needed to be cut, although after the article I did learn a lot more about hedge cutting from people like yourself and other farmers. But I kind of didn't understand why they had to be cut so aggressively, so mm-hmm. so small,
yeah.
Both height and width, and why they had to be cut every year. Because you'd see, so because I'm primarily I'm interested in insects more than other groups. When you're interested in insects, you kind of become automatically you notice small scale things,
yeah.
So tiny variations in habitat, and you'd see the hedges that will grow out, and you'll see the different heights and patches of shade and little pockets of bramble or hops or whatever growing on hedges. And you see all that complexity, which is amazing for insects, that would build up over the year, and then it would all go, but it would all be replaced by a tiny square box hedge. And I mean, the majority of hedges where I live now, because it's only really since coming to Somerset that I've noticed it in a more scientific way and paid a lot more attention as I've been driving around, although I used to see the hedge flailing all over the country. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the hedges around where I live are cut to that sort of size and shape. There aren't very many that are left sort of bigger and more suitable for wildlife.
Yeah.
And I just had been thinking about writing an article about that for quite a while, and I eventually did. And really, I used brown hairstreak butterfly as a sort of a starting point for the article. So that species lays its eggs on blackthorn, and it's in Somerset, which has managed to retain quite good populations, which means it does still actually have a good number of hedges spread out across Somerset.
Yeah.
I've lost track, but so that species likes young blackthorn. So if you cut it every year, it's unsuitable for the butterfly. It can't survive. It needs some of the shoots to be left. And there were studies done that showed it only needed about 10-20 centimeters left. There's not very much. But I did some volunteer surveys for that species, and it took me ages to find a hedgerow that was suitable to survey for it. Because most of them have been flailed too much, so there was no point in looking for it on those. And the article was just exploring some of the ecological evidence for why flailing hedges annually to that scale is bad for insects and berries and birds and plants, and then looking at and it was almost a bit of an emotional plea from myself. to say, could we just let a little bit, could we cut them on rotation? Could we let them get a bit bigger, that kind of thing? And it generated some really good conversations with farmers on Twitter, which I didn't necessarily expect, but that was really, really good. And I learned a lot more from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it did make me... sort of think about things, because I mean, a lot of the time, I think, and I'm speaking for all farmers, I speak for myself, but I'm rushing around all the time and I don't always notice. But what that article made me did was, when I was walking my dog around the farm, I started looking a bit closer at the hedges, and I did notice a few places where I could And I thought, well, there is a gap there. I could do something with, or I could let that edge go a bit bigger. But usually I'm so busy running around,
yeah,
under pressure trying to pay the bills, and you don't always notice, you don't always see it, but you would be looking at it in a different, with a different eye, I suppose.
I completely understand that, because, yeah, I mean, I'll go out walking with people, and my eyes, I've trained myself maybe to, my eyes will be scanning every leaf for insects, and I'll find things, and people are like, oh, how did you find that? And it's kind of like, well, you, once you get your head like trained for it and your eyes used to it, then you start seeing things. But if you're not used to seeing things, then you won't notice them. No. So yeah, I can understand. But yeah, that's really nice. I'm glad that it did sort of help you to look at it in a different way.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we are actually looking to plant a bit more hedge as soon as this year. But Britain's quite unique with that, isn't it? With the hedges. I mean, people listening in other countries won't quite realise just how many miles. You know, most of us have hedges on the farms, don't we?
Yeah.
It is a hugely important natural resource in terms of tourism as well, doesn't it? You know, that picture postcard landscape that you see when you fly into Britain and you see the hedges, it's a special thing, isn't it? And it should be cherished, really.
Yeah, and also ecologically, because we've lost sort of a lot of our woodlands and a lot of that kind of scrubby habitat's gone as well. Hedges are often one of the only places where species that actually use those kind of hedgerow plants or trees couldn't survive. So their hedgerows automatically then become a lot more important for wildlife, because it's one of the remaining kind of areas on farms where you can sometimes get a bit more, I don't know, I guess habitat structure and some diversity in some of the shrubs. So I mentioned butterflies in that article, but I did mention moths as well. And for moths, they're even more important, because there's a lot more species, and a lot of species feed on a lot of our common hedgerow plants like hawthorn and blackthorn, and hedgerow trees like ash and things like that are really, really important for those. And then it kind of rebounds up the food chain, because all of the moth caterpillars are food for birds, and then it goes on and on in that way.
Yeah. So are you encouraged by Michael Gove has been talking about a green Brexit and using Brexit as an opportunity to maybe correct some of the wrongs that have been done in the past to the environment in this country? Do you think that's going to give us an opportunity to move forward with it and improve the countryside?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I describe myself as, I have cautious optimism, but I'm also a bit skeptical about what he and his department have been saying.
That makes two of us.
Before the Brexit vote, a lot of conservationists were saying that, obviously, majority of charities didn't want to leave because they wanted to keep the environmental regulations that sort of exist because of the EU. Mm-hmm. But they were saying that it would offer an opportunity to redesign agri-environment policy. Mm-hmm. And I read a bit about it, but I didn't really think that much about it at the time. But now that a lot of these proposals and plans have been being put forward by Michael Gove and others, they do sound really, really, really good. So I went to the Cornwall AOMB farming conference about a month ago, and George Eustace spoke, sort of the MP, he's involved with DEFRA, about the government's plans. And some of the things he mentioned, so things like trying to make it less bureaucratic, to have a rolling deadline for entering schemes, removing single farm payments, a basic area payment, and trying to move it towards all for paying for public goods and the environment, and focusing more on soils. A lot of the things that he was saying from a conservationist perspective, sounded really, really good. Until I guess I see actions happen, I won't sort of believe it. And also, I think the thing I'm learning more with agri-environment, because I work with Natural England quite closely on the moors and can sometimes input into farmers' agri-environment schemes when they have these butterflies, is that at the moment the scheme is too complicated, there's too much paperwork, and there's not enough money.
Yeah.
So that's partly why farmers are put off.
You've summed it up very well there.
Also, Natural England themselves don't have enough staff to do the job properly. And if the new scheme doesn't actually address those things, which might mean it needs more money, if it doesn't get more funding, then I'm not entirely sure if it will be able to deliver kind of what they want it to and actually change things. Because I know over recent years, it seems like agri-environment schemes have been, the money's been getting lower. And because there's farmers that I work with who've just, say, come out of higher tier, so they've been in for 10 years, and they might have been in schemes before that, so they might have been in schemes for a long time, but they're deciding not to go in anymore.
Yeah.
And that's such a shame, and it's not very good, really, because it's public money that's been spent for so long, and then it's all gone.
Yeah.
And I think it needs more money, I would say.
Yeah.
And they haven't mentioned anything about that. Yeah, about how much funding they're going to put in.
Yeah. Well, I've never found an agri-environmental scheme that works for our farm, because of what you say, really. It's never really paid us to do it. We're quite a lowland, fairly productive farm. We haven't got sort of woodland or any wet corners or steep hills to put in it. So it means taking land really out of production. And I've just never found one that pays us to do it, but I wish I could. I'd absolutely love to. But
do you think that, because this is one thing that I'm interested in trying to understand more, is do you think that most farmers will need or want to be paid to do environmental enhancements? Because I mean, I know in my job there are some farmers who actually are doing conservation work off their own back. They're not being paid to do it, so they do more than they actually have to.
Yeah.
But I don't know what you think.
I think everyone does. Well, I wouldn't say everyone, but I think an awful lot of farmers do that, because at the end of the day, it's our home, isn't it? I mean, most of us will, in the summer evening, you go for a walk around the farm. There's nothing nicer than seeing wildlife and hares running around, and your butterflies and bees. I mean, I think we all want to see more of that on our farms, because we do treat it as an extension of our garden, really. But I think at the same time, commercial realities dictate that most of us are extremely time poor.
Yeah.
And most of us have got, at the very least, an overdraft. And, you know, the priority is production to pay the bills. I think that is the reality of it to an extent.
I guess if you could be paid more for your produce, that would maybe help.
Oh, without a doubt. But I mean, that's a whole different that's a whole different story. But yeah, I think Gove said that the new environmental schemes coming in, the cornerstone of future ag policy in England. So we'll wait to see about the rest of the country, and we'll wait to see whether it works. They've made it all sound very simple, but
I think that's the thing. When I saw George Eustace give the speech, he did make it sound it was going to be easy, but it won't be. No. And I think I think it'd be very easy for them to make mistakes with the way it's designed, and make it too bureaucratic without realizing. Yeah. And I think they need to sort of take time over it, and maybe obviously they've just done this consultation, but you know, maybe get some farmers or people to help and get conservationists to help. And because I think there's a lot of expertise in the country in both farming and conservation who could give a lot of good help to actually designing a sensible scheme.
Okay. All right. And we'll change in tack slightly. I do want to ask you about this extremely emotive word for farmers, rewilding. It sort of brings up a range of emotions, doesn't it, that word? What is rewilding as you understand it?
Well, the simple definition that I like, that I saw given was at a talk by Charlie Burrell, who runs NEP Estate in Sussex. And he described it as process-led minimal intervention. So a form of, we could call it land management, but a form of having your land where you're being led by ecological processes. So you don't necessarily have a management plan. You're just letting those processes play out.
Okay.
And minimal intervention. So you're doing as little in human intervention in that on the land as possible.
Yeah.
So that's a definition which I think covers it. But there has been an interesting diagram produced by Steve Carver, who tweets a lot about rewilding, which he puts it as it's almost like a spectrum of rewilding. So at one end they would be maybe farmland, and at the other end of the rewilding spectrum there'd be complete wilderness, where, you know, which I don't know if we have many wilderness areas like that in this country, maybe somewhere up in Scotland. But those two ways are quite good. The spectrum diagram that he uses is quite good because it does show you that there's different almost levels of rewilding approach. One of the problems with the word rewilding is it's used to describe so many different things now. I think a lot of people and conservation charities as well have sort of jumped on the bandwagon with it, and they can almost say, oh, rewild your garden and all these kind of things, which isn't really, I think, what it was originally intended to mean when the word was started to be used more. But because the actual idea of it's become so popular, people use it for lots of things, and so it can be quite confusing to know what people mean by it.
Because I mean it is used, you know, obviously I don't want to mention George Monbiot too much, but I mean it's a word that he throws around quite a lot. I guess it's a buzzword, isn't it, like you said, and it immediately gets farmers' backs up, I think, because we don't really we don't necessarily understand what they want from us with it. What when people talk about rewilding areas, well, how's that going to work, I guess, is what I'm saying.
A lot of people, when they talk about rewilding, if they talk about it within the context of farming, they it's a bit weird. Again, like the inevitable conclusion is that they mean stopping farming and giving it back over to nature, which obviously will annoy people like yourselves and farmers. And some people, that's what they want, and that's what they'll say, which is fair enough. It's often talked about in relation to the uplands a lot. The focus seems to be on the uplands. I did ask people recently on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, why they focus on the uplands so much, because I was just intrigued by that. And I think it's because they see that area as being more ecologically impoverished. Although, I don't know, you could argue that if you went to maybe some of the East Anglia where there's vast areas of arable, no Yes, anyway, that's similar. And I think it might be linked to the fact that there isn't there's big commons with no boundaries. So you look at it and you just see a big area of land and you kind of think, oh, we could just leave that now. You know, just get it's not, it doesn't look like it's owned by anyone, if you see what I mean. It's kind of, and I guess there's less buildings and farmhouses there. So I think people, that's why the focus is often on the uplands.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll leave rewilding for now. Okay. So you're also, a big part of your job is photography. We mentioned it earlier. If anyone's listening, have a look at your website, which is wildlifephelps.com, isn't it? You've got a hell of an eye for a picture. You've got some beautiful pictures on there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I should say it's not part of my job. I just do that as just in my spare time. So I've been doing photography since I did do it a bit when I was younger, but I never obviously had a good camera, just a little point and shoot. But I got more into using proper sort of SLR cameras sort of just after university. I just find it really relaxing and really enjoyed doing it. And I like to just use the images, because I focus more on wildlife, to just promote wildlife to people and show people things, really. I've never tried to make money out of it. I know some people that do, but I think it's quite hard to make a lot of money out of wildlife photography. You have to put a lot of effort in, and there's not that much money in it, I don't think.
Yeah. No. You must have to have a lot of patience, I guess. It's being at the right place and waiting for long enough.
Yeah, but that, I enjoy that. That's part of it. I can spend ages just chasing a butterfly around until it lands, and then you get close and it flies off again. But the more time you spend out, the more opportunities you'll have. It's such a good sort of thing to do, because I like doing macro photography, so close-up photography, and it means you really focus on the small things and look at tiny details and things around you that you might not normally look at.
Okay. And you've traveled around a bit as well, haven't you? So I guess you get opportunities while you're traveling to take pictures there too.
Only in recent years, when I've had a bit more money, I've been able to go on some sort of better holidays or nicer holidays. Last year went to visit my friend who works in Ethiopia, which was amazing. So I've never been to Africa before. So that was really exciting. We got to feed hyenas there, which was an incredible thing. And sort of saw things like crocodiles and other stuff. And then a couple of years ago, we went to visit a friend as well who lived in Burma, Myanmar. Again, that was the first time I'd been to Asia. There's just amazing things to photograph over there. And what I like about going to places like that is it, because culturally it's so different. There's I can try and do sort of photos of people or architecture and things, which I don't normally do in this country. I just do wildlife photography here. So it gives you different things to try and learn and do.
Okay. And where are some of your, when you're traveling around the UK, where sort of in a sort of environment sense, where are some of your favorite places to visit?
I love Scotland. Me and my girlfriend have been on holiday to Scotland 4 times now. There was a period where we were going every year. So we've been to the Cairngorms 2 times, and then we've been to West Coast a couple of times as well. And I just love it there. And there's so much there that I could probably keep going there for the rest of my life and not actually see it all. Areas, but I really like the southwest now. So I do really like Somerset Levels. That's Somerset has some amazing sort of habitats. It's got nice bits of coastline as well and hilly areas. I like the Northumberland coast as well. Yeah. Holiday there a few times to the Farne Islands and other places. But all the other areas I've been to, sort of key places people go, like Snowdonia and Lake District, Peak District.
Yeah.
I really like.
Yeah, okay. All right, and so well, I've probably kept you long enough. So what I'm going to do is wrap this up with a quick quiz, if you're ready.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so what is your all-time favourite song?
I think it's really difficult because I really, really love music.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Fade to Black by Metallica.
I was not expecting that. That is a brilliant choice.
Yeah, I love heavy metal and sort of other alternative music.
You wouldn't have put that with it. You wouldn't necessarily put that with a nature lover and a heavy metal music.
No.
That's awesome. Okay. If you could switch places with anyone on earth for 24 hours, who would it be?
Simon Reeve, just because he's a BBC travel presenter.
Okay.
Really like his travel documentaries, and he's got an amazing job going to travel around the world. And
cool. Okay. If you could observe and photograph one animal that you haven't yet done, what would it be?
I think it would be a clouded leopard in the Himalayas.
Wow. Okay. Are they the ones that were on BBC? Planet,
yeah, they were on
one of those, weren't they? It was awesome.
Yeah, they were on, I think they might have been on Planet Earth.
Planet Earth,
they're on
yeah.
one of their,
yeah.
They're on the Big Cat program they did.
Yeah. Okay. So if you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Probably everyone says this, but flying.
Yeah, okay. And lastly then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Again, I think a lot of people might say this to you, but it would be Herdwick Shepherd, mm-hmm. or James Banks on Twitter, yeah. Because he was one of the people that first people within farming I think I followed, and mm-hmm. has introduced me to lots of other things, and I think the way he talks about farming and conservation, I agree with most of what he says, and I think he seems very wise and to have good ideas about how we should value farming and mm-hmm. and the environment together. So yeah, I'd recommend him.
Yeah, okay. All right, Simon, well it's been really good to speak to you.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on, and hopefully we can continue the dialogue on Twitter.
No, very much so. Well, when I'm cutting hedges this autumn, I'll send you some pictures, and you can give me an appraisal. All right, thanks again, Simon.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you, and good night.